Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Carolina Wrestling Hall of Fame as we introduce and present Susan Green, one of the greatest lady wrestlers of all time. We're so privileged to have you with us today, Susan. How are you doing?
I'm doing good, John. How about you?
I'm doing great, especially wonderful because I'm going to get to talk about wrestling for a little while with you. And so what I'd like to do today is talk with you about some of the ladies that you knew, that you looked up to, that you worked with, and get your views on them and just tell us how it really was back then. I guess the list that I would like to talk about, let me give it to you, and we'll start at the top with Mildred Burke. Then we're going to talk about June Byers, the great Penny Banner, who was married to Johnny Weaver, who was one of my favorites when I was growing up. He was a wonderful wrestler. And, of course, Leilani Kai, part of the, part of a legendary tag team, the Glamour Girls, and just a phenomenal wrestler in her own right. So does that sound like a plan, Susan?
It sounds like a plan to me.
Okay, good. First of all, I believe that you had a lot of great things to say about Mildred Burke, what she accomplished, and your relationship with her. Is that correct?
Correct. Mildred
so,
was.
So tell us about how you met her and how you worked with her, and also, first of all, tell everyone exactly who she was, because I think she was truly great lady wrestlers of all time.
Well, she was the undefeated NWA women's world champion. And the female category back in the days in the 40s and all, they didn't do like they did the men. They had one, and Sam Lushnick was the president of the NWA as far back as I can remember. Until the NWA broke up, but she was ruled to be the West Coast NWA Women's World Champion because the promoters didn't see where it was fitting to fly a female from coast to coast worldwide like they did the men, as Luthez, Dory Funk Jr., Terry Funk, Jack Briscoe, Gene Kaminsky, Harley Race, they would fly them worldwide because they were the one and only NWA men's world champion. So they divided up the United States into three categories, the West Coast, the Central, and the East Coast. And Mildred was the NWA for the West Coast and undefeated. I ended up meeting her when I left Lillian Ellisor, the fabulous Millis girl wrestling camp in 74 for about 4 months. And I started driving a truck and going west to delivering paint to the Navy stations from Corpus Christi to San Diego and all. And I got in touch with her whenever I'd talked to Gene LaBelle. He was from over down there in the West Coast, Mike and Gene. And they said, that I could get a hold of Mildred, and she might be able to offer me some insight on the female wrestling that I could, and she might have more contact for me to get a hold of other than what I'd gathered from the 3 years that I'd been with Lillian. In the process, she called Sam Mushnick and phone holding tournaments and seeing my wrestling ability and sending me down to Mexico and all that she wanted to put the women's world title on me that she still held because she retired undefeated. And Sam had sat there and told her, if she thought that I was good enough to hold it, he had no debate, and of course I debated her. I was just wanting to wrestle. I didn't necessarily go out there to be the belt because I knew she was booking and training girls, and I would go in when I'd have a layover or something. I would go into the gym there for Mildred and help train the girls and work out with them, and then go in into Mexico and all, and I guess that was one of the shockers for Mexico when I went down into Mexico, and they sit there and said, well, we want you to drop the belt to, and I believe it was Lola Gonzalez, and I sit there and said, well, if she's able to take it, you know, I'll be more than happy to drop it. But
in other words,
I didn't get any
if
words.
She can beat you, it's hers, right?
Yeah, you know, I didn't get any word from Mildred or from Sam Mushnick that I was to drop the belt, you know, and that I was the world champion and I was to defend the belt as the world champion. Because everything with the NWA went through a board, you know, they debated and discussed on who would and do what they was going to do, you know, and be able to represent. And then the same thing when Mildred sent me to Japan for a week. And I guess that was a thing, you know, I would go over and I'd tell Mildred when I'd be out there, I said, you know, well, I'm going to be out there and I've only got 7 days or I got 5 days or I, and she would get me these bookings for going overseas to defend the belt for this 5 or 7 days, you know, for one match. And I sat there and said, which for Lillian, we went for months, you know, when we went overseas. I mean, it wasn't no 5 days or 6 days or a week. It was, you know, you were going to be there for 3 to 6 to 7 months. And I sit there and I guess Mildred was another one that actually taught me how to make money, you know, because she said, if they want to take you out to dinner and they want to be seen with you, then they'll pay a price to take you out. And it's like, well, they're paying for the dinner. And it's like, no, but they want to be seen. And I went, oh. So, you know, when I'd be over there for $3,000 for the one match, and then I'd sit there and say that to make a public appearance, it was going to cost them another $500 or $600, and to go out to dinner and them pay for the meal, then it was going to cost them another $400 or $500, and it would be that they were getting the publicity of being seen with me, and I was doing these public appearances and all that, and I said, you know, where I might have been going over for $3,000 for that one match, I was coming back with $5,000 or $6,000 in my pocket because of all the extras they wanted me to do. And of course, they wanted you over so you wouldn't have jet lag for the fight and all that. And I said, working for Lillian, normally it was you flew in and you wrestled that night. There was no concern about jet lag. Yeah, you know, it was just, and it wasn't no thousand. It was a couple of hundred for a week. You know, they did pick up the motel, but they didn't pay for your food or anything. So, you know, you were paying her. Well, when I went with Lillian, it was, she got 30% of the week's pay. And then you had to take out for your food. And you know, the only thing that they paid for was your airfare and your hotel and your travel, you know, whatever, however you had to travel over there. And they picked it up. But I said, basically, first time I went from Lillian, I was making $140 for stay in Japan. But with Mildred, you know, she sat there and said, every little thing they want you to do, just put a price on it. You know, and then when I sat there and she saw me training with the girls and all, and then I sat there and said, you know, when are we going to be able to do some of the other states? And she said, well, that Lillian Mula had that kind of tied up because her girls had regular jobs and didn't really depend on wrestling all that much. You know, when they first started, they did. And I guess one of the biggest stars that Mildred had was Rhonda Singh, Monster Ripper, which, a.k.a. Bertha Faye for the WWE. She was a monster in Japan and Mexico. Everybody recognized her just walking down the street, you know.
Did Bertha Faye, did she train with Mildred?
Yes, Mildred actually trained her. She came down from Calgary, Canada, to be trained by Mildred. I actually traveled after I lived in Mula when my neck and back was broke in 79. I guess it was about 84 that Rhonda Singh and I started traveling the country. I mean, we went to China, we went over to Russia, we was in Africa, India. I can actually say I traveled more with and saw more of the world with Rhonda Singh wrestling as an independent than I did wrestling under Moolah. You know, and it was being an independent when the promoter saw that you had something to offer and that you were, you know, there and different I guess that I did show up. If I had to rent a car because my car broke down, I would get there one way or another to make a town and tell them, you know, look, I broke down or something. I might be later, but I'd be calling to sit there. And I said, I guess that was the biggest deal with Mildred's girls. Whenever they had to work over or something for in California and Arizona and all, you know, they would not be able to make some of the bookings because their regular job called for them to have to stay. And Rhonda was one of the ones that, being from Canada, she relied on, she looked to wrestling to make her livelihood and all. So, Mildred was one that, she never saw, charged me a percentage when she sat there, and I agreed that I'd give her 15%. And then when she saw that I was willing to train the girls and work out with the girls, and if they had any questions and if they wanted to ride, I would, the company I was working for was giving me the car because I'd have a layover for pain or whatever, you know, whenever I was working for Mildred, because I was driving a truck, you know. And I'd sit there and say, you know, they didn't owe me anything, you know, or buy me a Coke or a hot dog, you know, when we left. You know, I didn't charge them anything for riding with me from town to town. I looked at that. They were giving me, doing me a favor, being able to be available for me to wrestle when I had a layover out on the West Coast. And Mildred was able to get a few bookings around Arizona and Los Angeles with the LaBelles because they saw that I was one of Moolah's girls at one time, and they knew that I would be there, and then
right.
They figured that if I was there, that Mildred's girls would show up because they had heard all the news of me going in the gym, working out with these girls and all. But Mildred was one of the best, and I sat there and said she had a natural body to where she didn't have to work out very much, and I said it was well before any steroids was involved in getting the muscles and back in the day Mildred started out wrestling in circuses, you know, or carnivals where, you know, she'd take on the men and if they could beat her in 10 minutes they got $25. Yeah, so she was a tough cookie. You know? Whenever you stepped in, she didn't care what size the man was either, you know, she'd step up and take them on any challenger for the 25. But I sat there and said that she earned all the respect that the NWA gave her as being the world champion.
Right, really, as long as they did. I know there was some skullduggery involved with Billy Wolf, who was her husband at one point.
Oh, yeah.
And that's correct, isn't
it? Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, but. Yeah, she was something else. And then after those days with the NWA were over, she also started the Ladies Professional Wrestling Association?
Yes, she actually started it really before, I guess, to where the NWA wasn't backing the females anymore. So she started the West Coast or the Midwest Women's Association. And had a belt made up to where she didn't put the NWA belt up as the women's champion. Of course, that belt wasn't declared as being the world champion. It was just the women's championship. And it was passed among not just the girls she trained, but a lot of, because her and Billy Wolf did, Moolah and Buddy Lee booked the girls at one time out here on the East Coast. They had other girls that were working for other promotions that they would bring in and out. and switch the belt. Amongst them, you know. And whenever one of the girls sit there and say she's getting tired of wanting to start a family or whatever, they knew it was time to drop that belt to somebody else that was looking forward to making wrestling part of their livelihood.
Right. Well, it sounds like those were exciting times. Now, when you were over in Japan, and I'm guessing this was for Mildred, isn't that when you were attacked by one of your partners in the ring at some point?
No, that was actually my first trip that I went over for Mildred. Not Mildred, for Moolah.
Oh, really? Well, Moolah, could you tell us about that? Because that's a you told me that story a while back, and I find it very, very interesting.
That was one of those things. We flew in that morning, and we were in the ring at the Tokyo Dome that night. And I was going up for the Japanese championship, and my partner over in Japan, you back in the 70s and even before that, you would have somebody stand in your corner. It was almost like a boxer. They had somebody standing in the corner for you on the floor, not in the actual corner of the ring, like a tag partner. I was wrestling Chicho Obata, which was their champion, she had two girls, Terry, and I don't remember what Terry's last name was, and they called her Baby, and I don't, became all I remember is Baby. But they were standing out there for Baby to understand why everything was being done, and I said, the match was going, I said, Chicho kept jumping out, and of course, you know, the ringside, the people were sitting on the floor, so that was a shocker to me, because it was my first trip, to Japan, and it was my first trip overseas where you sit on the floor and not in a chair. So I'm sitting there, and I looked at my tag partner, Peggy Patterson, and she's on the ground, and I turned around and looked at her, and she just shrugged her shoulders at me, and I walked over the corner, and I said, if she keeps jumping out of the ring, I'm going after her. You know, I mean, this is ridiculous. I come here to wrestle, and if she was going to run all night, they should have gave me the night off, because we just flew, I think, 9 hours and getting off and getting everything unpacked and getting ready. So I said, we'd been up, I'd probably been up 24 hours with just whatever sleep I could get on the plane. And I said, that wasn't very much if you ever tried to sleep on a plane. But I said, Chicha slid out, and I slid out right behind her about for the 7th or 8th time. And never even thinking about that her people were going to come walking up behind me, that, you know, this is a single match. They're not supposed to be bothering me. Well, as I walked up to grab Chicha, I said, I felt something hit me in the head. And I just shrugged it off. I thought, well, if a fan hit me, I wasn't going to sit there and acknowledge that they hit me. I mean, they did take a wallop, you know, and it did. I did see a few stars when my feet rang my bell. Chicha jumped back up in the ring, and I walked over to my corner where Peggy Patterson was standing, and I sit there and turned around, and I said, is it bad? Well, when I turned back around, her eyes were like silver dollars. And she couldn't say anything, you know. Well, I just climbed back up in the ring. And of course, instead of jumping over the top rope, I stepped through the ropes. And when my hair fell from over my shoulders down in front of my face, and I spun around, and it, instead of being blonde, it was now blood red. I spun back and looked at her, and I said,
wow,
it is bad. And all she could do is shake her head. The referee couldn't speak English. And Chicha and Terry and them said they couldn't speak English. I mean, how they, and I sure, it was my first trip to Japan, so I knew not near a word of Japanese. So in the process, I'm trying to grab Chicha to pin me, because I'm realizing I'm trying to hold her down on me, and she kept pushing up, so she wouldn't pin me. And then after about 10 minutes into the match, because this happened within 3 minutes, of the ring of the bell, you know, well, I turned around and looked at Peggy, and the time limit was 30 minutes. I looked at Peggy, and I sit there and said, you know, if she thinks she's going to beat me, she's going to have to kill me. You know, I tried to let her beat me so I could get out of the ring to get back to the back to get medical treatment. And then, needless to say, she wouldn't pin me. You know, and of course, when it got time to that she wanted to pin me, I wasn't going to let her pin me. So I sit there and said, I like to beat her to death, but I sit there and said, I ended up pinning her for the championship, you know, because we just went to beating each other to death. I mean, it became a shoot. That the better girl was going to win. Whoever could outlast the next one was going to be the one that had their hand raised. And I said that when it was over, I was so tired, and there was so much blood in the ring. And they have a rubber coating over the canvas, so whenever I was trying to push myself up, I was sliding in my own blood with my hands. And then Peggy had jumped up there to help me, and Bobby, which it was his first tour from being trained by Vern Gagne, he come running out to help me, which he became Sergeant Slaughter in later years, but it was his first tour, you know. And he was saying I was all right, and I said, you know, next to being next to dead, I guess I was all right.
Good. How many stitches did all that take?
They ended up strapping me to a gurney. They would not take me down in the elevator because they didn't want to get it bloody. They carried me down the stairwells, strapped to a gurney, and me sitting there threatening to kill them if they dropped me. You know, we were five stories up. But when I got to the hospital, they ended up strapping me down and holding me so they could sew me up. And of course, they cut all my hair off other than a few little bangs. So now not only am I bald-headed, but I had 35 stitches in the back of my head. And they wrapped my head up to where I looked like a mummy. And I called Mula to sit there and say, you know, there's no way. And it's like, well, if you don't wrestle, you got to figure out how to pay your way home. And you won't be paid. And then I thought, well, there's no way I can pay my way home. And they did take my plane ticket, so there's no way I can get to the airport without them not knowing that I'm going. I'm trying to get out of there, and I wouldn't have left Peggy to defend for herself over there anyway. You know, she'd been over to she was actually one of Mildred Burke's girls, and she came to Mula in the late 60s, I guess, whenever she got tired of running back and forth between Japan and Mexico. To be able to wrestle in the States from Mula. But she was at the hospital, and of course, she couldn't tell them what, you know, don't cut her hair all off, just cut the way that they would have done here in the States, just cut a strip to where they could have sewed it up and kept the hair out of the stitches. But 35 stitches later, and each night I had to wrestle, and each night they took me to the hospital for them to cut the bandage off my head and face and so they could disinfect it and I could be ready for the next day. You know? It was amazing it was a learning experience, but it was amazing that they wouldn't give you a break. You know, I would have thought they'd have gave at least a week to kind of let the stitches get hold and start holding together, but they expect you to go out there and do it exactly everything that they, you know, the suplexes and all, you know, they weren't going to hold anything back. And if it busted open, well, they just, you know. And back in the 70s, if you were an athlete, they didn't give you any anesthesia. They held you down and sewed you up with no deadener. So I took 35 stitches in the back of my head with nothing other than just guts. You know. Of course, I will say I was
taller. What was the rationale behind that? Why would they do that?
because I was tough, I was a wrestler. And if you're going to be a wrestler in Japan, you've got to be tough. Yeah. And I thought, well, I was a wrestler, but I wasn't from Japan, and I wasn't brought up in Japan. You know, when you were hurt, you're supposed to have a few days to recoup. But in Japan, they didn't give. And I don't know that any of the guys got hurt on any of the trips that I was ever over in Japan, to where they had to worry about it. But I know some of the other countries that I've been in, when the guys got hurt, they got time off. Yeah. Here in the States, Randy Tyler had got stabbed in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and Leroy McGirt was a promoter for the Oklahoma Louisiana territory, or the head, and Randy actually got 2 weeks off for the stab. You know, of course, the stab ended up, he had six stitches from being stabbed by a fan, but I sit there and said, that was, he wouldn't have got it if he had been in Japan, and it wouldn't have mattered that it was, that he got it, you know, went between two ribs, and luckily didn't puncture a lung. But I sit there and said that in Japan, you know, it was had no mercy.
Right. Well, that's amazing. So, in all your interactions with Mildred, she was a good person and did her job well. And do you have any funny stories about just you and Mildred you'd like to share?
You know, I guess it was really funny. You know, I considered it an honor that she wanted to get up in the ring and work out with me. You know, the time that I spent with at Moolah's, you know, she never just went out to the gym to work out. You know, and she never worked out. You know, she'd see you work out, and then if you was on the road with her and got the wrestler, then you got the wrestler. But for Mildred to think enough of me to want to get up there and feel the thrill or the excitement of being in the ring, and I sit there and said, you know, for the girls, her girls, to see her get up in the ring and but she would actually get up in the ring and train with the girls. You know, she didn't leave it to just one girl or another like Moolah did, because it was, when I first got to Moolah's, it was Donna Christantello or Vicki Williams that really trained the girls. And after I got there, I was always in the gym wanting to learn something new, and I would wrestle my imaginary opponent to where I could get things down, get better at what I did. But Mildred, you know, coming out one time when I believe I was working out with Jane O'Brien, or it might have been Sandy West when we were fixing to go over to Japan. I think it was Sandy West. We were going to be partners, and because we looked alike. She had the blonde hair, and I said the only thing different was I was wearing the Western boots, and she still wore lace-up boots. She was, Mildred said, could she get up? And I think we was actually wrestling again, working out against Jane O'Brien and another girl that the name don't come right to mind right now. And Mildred got up there and did some stuff and said that I reminded her of her younger days, you know, that I wasn't afraid to take a punch and I wasn't afraid to throw a punch. And it was like, well, you know, hit me as hard as you want to, but, you know, I'm going to hit you back. And she said, that's the way it should be.
Exactly right. Well, I know it was an honor to work with Mildred and to carry that World Heavyweight Championship belt over to Japan for her and keep it.
So you brought it
right back to her. Now, the Ladies Professional Wrestling Association that she started, how did that fare? Is that the one that's still running now over in Europe?
No. That one was actually started by Randy Powell. He was from Wilkesboro, North Carolina, North Wilkesboro. Now he's living in Raleigh, Durham. He just happened to come up with the same name and not realizing that it had been done all those years back. But Randy, you know, he started here in the States and when the girls started doing, like, the girls at WWE or at the time WWF, you know, they was exposing more than he wanted to bring back the old style of wrestling. And they wanted to be the divas and all of wrestling. And Penny Banner and myself, we tried to talk to him and say, you know, you don't want to make a living off what your body is. You might have a good body and a nice body, but you want your ability to get you where you're going. You don't want to be your, as me and Penny would say, and as a lot of the guys say, and promoters even, they call it TNA. You know,
right.
If you're willing to expose yourself more than you have to if you've got the ability to wrestle. And I always relied on my ability, and Mike LaBelle and Gene LaBelle out in California, they sit there and said that whenever they were using me there on the West Coast when I was driving the truck, they knew that I was willing to not show any more than I had to show, you know, that I wore the one-piece bathing suits and didn't rely on, and they saw me, one of the girls didn't know how to put the band in her legs that worked for Mildred to keep the bathing suit down from riding up and showing more of her rear than you had to. And I sit there and ended up fixing her bathing suit to where she could tie the legs down to where it wouldn't ride up whenever she was out there. Because if you didn't put extra elastic in the legs and make it extremely tight, the legs were going to ride up and you were going to be exposing more your rear than you had to if you put this elastic in the legs. So, you know, but the bathing suits we wore, they weren't special made like they are today for WWF. You know, it was just we went out and we bought a bathing suit off the rack, you know, and I wore the Catalinas and the DeVilles, you know. I mean, I was paying $200 for a bathing suit back in the 60s and 70s, you know, which would be unheard of, you know. But I said, nowadays I go out and look and the bathing suits are $200 and $300 if I want to get a good bathing suit that I know that when I end up sliding across the ring, that it's not going to tear or rip. And I still have to fix the legs and the arms to make sure that the arm don't slide off my shoulders. Of course, I got broad shoulders, so I didn't really have to worry about doing much on the straps of the bathing suit to keep them up on my shoulders, tighten them up. Just had to worry about tightening the legs.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, now, you also knew, and I don't really know much of your history, with June Byers. Can you fill us in on that? Because she was another great one. She was like the Midwest Ladies World Heavyweight Champion, right?
Yeah. Well, she was considered the Central U.S. NWA Women's Champion, World Champion, and she was undefeated. But she represented, I don't know exactly where the divide line went for the West Coast and the Central, but I'm going to sit there and say probably in New Mexico and straight up and over into Louisiana and up where she wrestled the Central. And it might be kind of like the Central time zone. That might have been how they figured out where the Central was as to – but she wrestled the Central, and she lived just outside Houston. And I'd go by and talk to her, and Joe Blanchard set up a meeting and with me to talk to her, and it was like, you know, that I was dead set. And of course, she knew that I had offers from colleges with my swimming from high school and everything, and it was like, you know, don't you think you want to go to college? And I said, no, you know, I think I really want to start wrestling. You know, I want to travel and see the world paid while I'm doing it. And then she talked and sat there and told me all the highs and lows, you know, that we wouldn't get paid what we deserved. We wouldn't be looked at as being the athlete that the men were, and we could probably out-wrestle, and you would probably see that you were able to out-wrestle a lot of the men that were getting paid more. But, you know, you're just going to have to learn to deal with it if that's what I really wanted to be, you know, to be the wrestler. And,
well,
when she learned that I was going to be going to Mula, you know, Joe said, well, she's looking at going out to Lillian Ellisor's, and then she sat there and said, you know, well, there you're going to have to learn to walk to the beat of your own drum. And in the beginning, I didn't realize what she was really saying, you know, that and then basically was that Mula was going to play us as her little puppets and have us jumping around and doing all she wanted, where, you know, if we walked our own drum and did what we wanted, then she wouldn't have the control over us or over me as she did so many other girls.
Right. Right. Now, did you ever get to wrestle June Byers?
No. She had retired by the time that I had got in. You know, I got to see her wrestle. You know, I was a fan and saw her wrestle and defend the NWA World Belt, which whenever I came out to Lillian's, I didn't realize that she was the world champion, you know, because I had seen Mildred Burke and read about her in the books, and I had seen June Byers wrestle and defend the world championship for the NWA. And of course, everybody needs to understand that Mula's belt was not the NWA world belt. She had this belt made and won it in a tournament they had set up in Baltimore, Maryland. And if you looked at the belt, you will actually see the date she won it in Baltimore, Maryland, with her name underneath it. You know, it's small, but it's over to the side, and it just says Women's World Championship. It does not say NWA. Although the NWA would sit there and didn't care that the promoters advertised it as the world champion. They never really put the name, they never put the letters NWA in front of it whenever she was defending
right.
it.
Because now, from what I understand, Mae Weston was actually the East Coast NWA World Heavyweight Champion.
Yeah, I believe so. Yeah.
And she was a tough cookie too. Now, did you ever get to wrestle her?
No, I didn't. I met her out at the Cauliflower Alley, and you know, we're looking at women that 130 pounds. You know, maybe they might have been a little more. Mildred, you know, was and when I say beefed up in her major wrestling days, it wasn't that, you know, it was just that she did a lot of running and weightlifting and all, because she was coming out of doing the carnival and the circus fighting and men, you know, so she had to keep herself toned and trained with weightlifting and stuff. They were solid. When you hit them, it was like you were running into a brick wall. It wasn't that you were running into somebody that would be your average 120-pounder. That the heaviest thing they picked up was a phone or a notepad, you know. That they actually were physical in their ability of being able to wrestle, you know, and took care of themselves.
Wow. I mean, I imagine you had to take care of yourself to be able to stand all the wrestling that you did day in and day out. What were you wrestling, like four to 6 days a week?
Oh, 6 to 8 times, because in Japan they did 2-a-days, but the Americans, most of the time you'd have a 12 o'clock show, and then you'd wrestling and they'd get you back on the train and you'd go to another town. And, of course, the Japanese people would already be there, the wrestlers would already be there and have everything set up. So we didn't wrestle the same ones. If you if you wasn't in shape and ready, that it was not unusual to go, you know, for me to go to Japan and end up losing 20 or 30 pounds simply because of not being able to eat the way I'd eat over here and having to do the 2-a-days, which is just a whole lot more calories than what you were ingesting. And now, here in the States, there's only a few times that you'd have to wrestle. But I said, if you're on the road, you were normally had Sundays off. And I said, our Sundays, being female-wise, it was, that's when you found a laundromat to where you could get all your clothes washed and done, because I said we were going from town to town to town to town. So you couldn't even send them out to the cleaners because you weren't going to be back in that town for maybe 3 or 4 months.
Wow. That's amazing. I don't know about you. I was over in Japan. I got tired of raw fish. Is that what you had to eat when you were over in Japan? That's just a little personal question here.
They tried to shove it down. I ended up getting hooked on what they call Napoleon spaghetti, and it had no spaghetti sauce, but it had all kinds of vegetables on it. That's where I fell in love with snow pea pods. It was just the noodles with no sauce, but had all these vegetables in it. But the fish, they tried to cram it down our throat. and I learned whenever promoters were taking you out in the little small towns or towns that they'd sit there and they'd always have a big Japanese something. Well, I ended up learning real fast to sit there and say I was vegetarian. And this happened to be with Bobby Sergeant Slaughter. He was on one side of me, and of course Peggy Patterson, my tag partner, was on the other side of me, and we're sitting on the floor, and this table's about 4 foot wide, you know, and of course they're all sitting there with their knees curled up under them. Well, I just sit down and walk, had napkins on my hands, and walked my legs up underneath them, and no, you're supposed to cross your legs. And I said, I'm not sitting on my knees. They'll fall asleep before I finish eating. And of course, the translator that we had, there was a good translator that time. And she had studied in Boston, and she was trying to explain, and I sat there and said, well, you explain to them, I can't sit on my knees. Well, she started laughing, and the promoters thought it was funny. And then I said that I was a vegetarian, so they were bringing all these vegetables out to me and fruits and everything. And Peggy on one side of me and Bobby on the Sergeant Slaughter on the other side of me, and they're sitting there saying, well, this is good, but it's a little chewy. And I said, if you like it, you better shut up and just eat it. Well, most of the people around us didn't know what I was saying because they were Japanese and didn't understand, and they're just smiling and laughing, and Bobby and Peggy sitting there just saying, well, this, you know, you strut. And I said, I'm vegetarian, I ain't trying it. You know, if you like it, you better shut up. Well, whenever they ended up asking the translator, Sue, you know, what it was, and she says, you want to know? And it's like, I said, you better not tell them. She starts laughing. Well, one of them had squid and the other one had octopus. Well, they couldn't get up fast enough.
I can imagine. I know. Been there, done that, Susan. That's why I just had to ask. And then it was so funny. After a week in Japan, I finally got to an airport, and there was a McDonald's, but it was a Japanese McDonald's, and it had things that I had never seen. I mean, they had corn on their Big Mac, and it was just, oh my God, it was terrible. But that's okay. It was a real adventure, and I got a nice watch out of it. Okay, so I mean, I got a Seiko covered in mother of pearl, so I was happy with that. But I know Japan is if you haven't been there a lot, it's really a culture shock. Now it just totally is. And so we covered, I guess, some of the major stars, but the two that we haven't, because one is Johnny Mae Young. How well did you know her, and did you ever get to wrestle her?
Yes, I got to wrestle her when I was 15 years old. I wasn't old enough to drive, and my brother drove me all the way up from Corpus Christi, or from Alice, my hometown, just outside Corpus Christi, to Phoenix, Arizona, and she beat the ever loving crap out of me.
She beat the tar out of you.
Yeah, she beat me until I was black and blue. And all in the mouth of about 10 minutes, I was turned. And I understood, you know, Joe always sat there and said, you know, whenever he was training men, Black Jack, he says, you know, you got to know where you're at in that ring, whether you're upside down, right side up, on your head, on your toes, flying through the air, flipping through the air, sliding across the mat. You need to know where you are. Well, after I got out of the ring with Johnny May, I understood exactly what he was talking about, because I don't know that she ever let go of me. I'd hit the mat, and next thing I know, I'd be beaten, grabbed, and getting picked up. But I was a whopping 112 pounds, and she was probably 180. You know, she had me petrified when I walked in, because there she was with a cigar in her mouth when I walked in the dressing room. I've had a lot of people sit there and say, was she drunk? And you know, because that's why promoters had quit using her back in her later years. And when I sat there and said, I was so scared whenever I saw the cigar that I didn't even think about looking for drunk. Yeah. But my brother goes all the way to, yeah, just hang on. I got 10 minutes to go. That was, I guess, if there was a ride to be on at a carnival or a circus, that would be one that I would not want to get back on. Once was enough.
Right. So that was the only time you wrestled her?
That was the only time I wrestled her. And then after Mula had died, I guess for the low things were looking sad and blue, and I'd been over there, and I sit there and said, well, anytime you want to come out, you know, I train my school, I train them on Sundays and, you know, through the week. But I'm over on this side of town for church, you know, I can come swing by and pick you up 1:30-ish, you know, we train at 2. And then she came out 4 or 5 times to watch me train my guys. Now, I had to tell my guys, you know, you got to understand, when you hit somebody, hit, don't stomp, because she's blind and she's not going to see what y'all are doing. She's going to go on what she hears, you know. And each time one of my guys threw a punch and it really connected good and looked good, she'd sit there and say, you know, that's how it's done. That's the way it ought to look, you know. And the guys would just look at me and I'd just shake my head. I said, you know, and of course, whenever we'd go to leave, and because my gym is in my backyard, and we'd go to leave, I would have her put her hand on my shoulder to walk behind me, to where when I was talking to them, that she would be in step with me, and not have to be leading her as if she was blind. You know, and she could see some shadows and stuff at that point, but it wasn't enough that, you know, that I wanted her to walk across my yard unassisted.
Right. I had no idea that she was that hard of sight.
Yeah. Her later years, in her 80s, it was really bad. You know, Diamond Lil, Katie, the little midget, she was in charge of getting Mildred's medication together each day and each evening to give her medication. Right up to the time she died, you know. She took Johnny May's medicine to her and handed it, you know, gave it out to her. Diamond Lil doesn't read and write that well. You know, I guess that they had trained her so well before Mula had died that, you know, this shape and this color is what she needs to take at this time, to where she, you know, she could remember the shapes and the colors of the pills to give Johnny May. But she must have done all right, because Johnny May lived up to in her 90s, I think 92. So
she sure did, and she was still taking falls at 91 years old, I think. Just an incredible, incredible woman. And she was, for a time, a world heavyweight champion, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
So another legend, a true legend who wrestled all over the country, well, all over the world, but especially wrestled a lot in the Southeast and in the Carolinas, was the world-famous Penny Banner. Now, you knew Penny fairly well, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. Penny was a sweetheart. She loved horses, and I loved horses. We could talk horses, and we could talk wrestling. So it wasn't that we were stuck on one subject. We had other things outside wrestling that took our interest. Yeah, and that we had in common. You know, she was very much into sports after retiring from wrestling, and which I didn't really know it, but she said in 1974, whenever she saw me jump over that top rope, and I was wrestling her in Anderson, North Carolina, or South Carolina, it is, when she saw me fly over that top rope, that she knew that it was time for her to step aside and let the young ones have it. We were getting bigger and stronger, and she ended up devoting her time between her horses and going into the Senior Olympics, and she did very well in the Senior Olympics with swimming.
Right.
And I think.
And she had a daughter she loved very much, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh yeah, Wendy. You know, me and Wendy don't communicate as much as I would like to, or she would like to. Every Christmas we end up saying, you know, well, it's that time of year. We all once a year communication, and meaning to call and talk. You know, I've seen her at a couple of wrestlers reunions where her mother has been being honored, and she comes to represent her mother, or receive whatever her mother is going to receive from the organization. But Wendy is, you know, she's into horses, and Wendy's husband, which, you know, they never forced her, and of course, Penny was married to Johnny Weaver, which was one of the big stars out here for Jim Crockett Promotions. They never or tried to sway their daughter into becoming a wrestler. You know, it's, you do what you want to do and be who you want to be. You know, don't let what we did or do try to sway you into being somebody that you don't want to be.
Right. So, now, was Penny ever involved with Moolah?
No. Penny was very much a thorn in Moolah's side, because she would sit there and say, you know, if everybody stood up, because she didn't think it was right that Moolah charged so much to do the bookings, when 60% of the time the promoter would call Moolah and say, I need girls. And she wasn't staying on the phone like so many people thought she was. You know, she did get on the phone at times and to get you a circle going, where you could work your way out to California, and then on the way back, you would work your way back. Of course, there was many a time that I finished in Vancouver, Canada, and my next stop was Columbia, South Carolina.
For the circle, huh?
Yeah, you know, that circle was broken for sure, you know. So, but, you know, it was that she would call, and they would use somebody else's, because Kansas had girls that they used, and then of course Detroit, the Sheik, had girls that he used, and we didn't get in those areas very often. It was only if they wanted to come in with faces, or they wanted to have a battle royal, and they'd end up bringing a tag team in from those, and then throwing the four or five girls that they normally would use and from that area and get you a battle royal, a 10-girl battle royal, or did this 6-man or an 8-man tag, or a female, I shouldn't say man, a woman tag team, where it'd be something different that they didn't see very often. That way, those areas could sit there and say that, you know, well, you're giving an eight woman tag team. Well, they would see that every once in a while, but for the man, with a woman, it would be basically once in a lifetime. No, you know,
just,
you might see that once every.
Crazy.
Yeah, you know,
yeah.
It's just something unheard of, and the promoter's throwing it out there. So of course, it was going to pull the crowd in because it was like, well, when are we going to be able to see this again? It's actually how I met Heather Feather up there for the Sheik, which before Rhonda Singh had started. She might have been starting for Mildred Burke training, and this was in the early 70s, I'd say 72. I don't remember what Jane's name was, but the Sheik had trained some girls, and Heather Feather, you know, she's probably 300 pounds, and he dressed her up kind of like they did in WWE or WWF whenever they did Rhonda Singh as Bertha Faye. They made her look a whole lot bigger than she was, she was one of the Sheik's girls that actually got to tour the U.S. because they hadn't seen anybody that big, you know. And I said, it was even more amazing when you saw Heather get out of the little Volkswagen and you'd see her get out, and it's like, oh, my gosh. It had to have heavy-duty shocks on it to hold it up off the float ground, you know. But she was a sweet girl, you know. And when I say sweet, you know, yeah. It just, everybody was so afraid of her size, you know, thinking, you know, if she falls on me, it's going to kill me. She did everything she could to keep from hurting me, you know. And I said, there now, she did step on my hand when I was her partner, and it did break my hand. But that was
you
just
broke your hand?
One of those, yeah, she broke my hand whenever she went to step in the ring. My hand was right there when she stepped in because I tagged her, and it broke my hand.
But you had to finish the match, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. The match went on. It was like, stay away from my hand.
Right. And
Mary Jane
Mull.
You know, that was one of the girls, Mary Jane Mull for the Sheik, that normally wrestled Heather Feather.
Did you get to meet the Sheik, and did you ever get to wrestle with him?
I met him. I was on the same cards with him when he was promoting. He had his ways, you know. Some people would agree with him, and other people wouldn't. You know, I was always happy when I finished the territory. You know, when I was leaving.
Did you when you were in and around? Did you ever meet the photographer Mike Lano? Because he did a lot of photography for the NWA and many of the territories.
Yes, I didn't know him as well as I did Gene Gordon, but I did meet Mike.
Yeah, I just seen him on a. On an interview, and it was great. It brought back some memories. It certainly did.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in your days in wrestling, who else did you wrestle with frequently? I've picked out some of the biggest stars that we know in ladies wrestling, but who are some of the other ladies that you wrestled with and became friends with and got to hang out with? And if you have any good war stories about traveling or whatever, we'd love to hear them.
I guess one of the biggest ones and names that really carried over through the 80s and would be Leilani Kai. Actually, when I picked her up at the airport, picked her up in Augusta, Georgia, to bring her to Moolah's to be trained, it was like, do you really want to do this? You know, because I had come back from working. Got in the truck and you know, this was the end of 74, the first of 75. And it's like, It might have been before I left. Anyway, it was like, are you sure? You know, because I knew she was putting, a lot of females, when they come in, they have the dream of getting rich. And you could see you see the dollar sign kind of twirling in their head, that, you know, once they get trained, they're going to be making all this money, and they look at everything that they see other people have, the men-wise, that you know, they're going to be able to do it and get the cars and everything. Well, Mula didn't really want females to have a car. You know, she'd rather put you on a bus or the train to get you there, and then you rely on the guys to travel. But I trained Lalani, but it was one of the, you know, I so wanted her to say that she'd go somewhere else to be trained and all, but it was, you know, she couldn't wait to get there, and I thought, well, I guess you get moved in, I'll see you in the gym. Mula walked her around and introduced her to the girls, and of course I started training her, and then Mula said, you know, have her ready in 3 weeks. And Sheila Shepherd was the girl that came from, I was going to New York to be a tag team against Mula and Lalani Kai, but I had to have Lalani Kai and Sheila Shepherd ready in 3 weeks because she had the bookings for us in 3 weeks to go to New York for a week. Yeah. And of course we all rode in Mula's Cadillac there, and of course I normally did the driving until we got to the town, and then me and Sheila would jump out and to the arena. We weren't seen driving up with our opponents, but I sit there and said that Mula always sit there and said, as long as they know a top breast lock, if they knew the collar and elbow or the lock up, the referee's position. And I said Mula normally called it the referee's position, and that's where you lock up, and then the top breast lock, a step over toe hold, and how to take their bumps, that she could have a match with anybody. So, you know, you just basically had to have three moves down, and Mula thought she was good enough to be in the ring.
I believe that was her philosophy.
Yeah, and I was on the road a lot with Paula Kay, and promoters ended up locking the way me and Paula wrestled each other because we didn't do all the hair pulling and stuff that the average female, as Mula would sit there and say, you know, you just bite and pull hair, you know, that if they got you in a hole and you're the heel, you just bite and pull their hair to get loose, you know. And Paula and I could do some chain wrestling as well as me and Tony Rhodes. You know, we did chain wrestling, and that was not really what Mula put in her category of what you needed to know. So
by chain wrestling, you're talking about Greco-Roman style wrestling, aren't you? Real wrestling. And you know when I see the ladies that can do it, they were superb at it. They really were. So Tony wrote. Now Tony was, she was with Mula for a while.
She was with Mula from 63 to 80. So she was with her almost 20 years.
I guess she could take it, having her money stolen from her for 17 years. That's amazing.
Yeah. You know, whenever I talk to Tony, it's like we were young and dumb. You know, we were brought up that we respected our elders, and then we didn't, what they said is what went. You know, we didn't dare challenge you wouldn't dare challenge your boss. You know, back in the day, if the boss said it, you know, you just did it. And if the boss said that's what you got paid, that's what you got paid. You know,
no negotiation on that one, was there?
Madison Square Garden, second girl, sellout crowd to ever wrestle in Madison Square Garden, and I was number 29 out of 30 matches, and I got $200 for that match. Go figure that one.
I don't think I can.
I said, Yeah, but you know, from my understanding, Wendy was getting upset because she was not getting the $6,500 or so that she thought she should have been paid for one show. When I thought one show, you know, if we'd have made $6,500 on one show, we'd have thought we died and went to heaven, you know.
Right. And did you know?
What Mueller let us know, we paid us, and $6,500 was half a year, you know, worth of work. And then
right.
She still got 30% of that.
So then you would have gotten about $4,500, and then after
yeah.
you paid your hotel and meals.
Meals, and of course I had a car payment that I was making. So, but I was wild enough that I played in a band, and I also drove a record for her boyfriend. So if I wasn't busy in the ring, I was making money. Yeah.
Instrument did you
and,
play
and of course,
in the band?
I played the bass.
Oh, okay. Do you still play it?
No. I actually have my great-nephew my instruments. You know, he came up, I guess, 3 years ago. Him and his buddies started messing around with guitars, and he started out with a little studio guitar, and then one of his buddies decided he didn't want to play the bass anymore, so he got his bass, and then another one decided not the drums. Well, at their house, they have a little studio deal that his parents let him set up the instruments in the studio room that where whenever they come over, they can do their jamming in the room. Of course, they all know now that, you know, they can jam as long as mother and daddy's not there. You know, when
right.
the family gets home, the playing gets over. But I you know, I did it. A friend of mine that was a singer that passed away recently, she played and was needing a bass player and all, and I sat down and said, well, that's another way to get away from when I'm not busy, that I can be busy. Yeah. And then with me being the wrestler, people would see me up there on the stage because we played the East Coast with the band. And they'd start saying, well, you know, we started getting a bigger crowd and stuff because I wrestled. So they associated with me, the bass player, as being with wrestling. So the clubs we played at were willing to pay a little more because we would end up getting bigger crowds.
That's a very interesting story. And then the other job you had was you drove a truck. You actually drove a record, didn't you?
Yeah, I drove the record for Mula's boyfriend at the time.
Now, what was his
name?
And
Bobby Mathis. He drove for Mathis Garage. And this was from 72 to 79 when my neck and back was broke.
Now, tell us about your neck and back getting broken.
I was at I played softball for a city league, and the team, we won the city championship that year in 79, and the sponsor was giving us a celebration party up at the Lake Murray here in Columbia. And I was watching one of the players, her and her husband had bought their boat up so we could ski and everything, and I said, well, there's having all the barbecue and the hamburgers and everything going on. And I'd already been out and skied, you know, and Dina was the female. She was driving the boat, and I started to jump off because they holler, you know, it's ready, come on shore. Well, one of the assistant coaches said, you know, let me make one round. And she said, well, you stay in so you can watch him, you know. And I thought, all right, you know, just I said, one round. And then they said, one round. So he started getting up. Well, she took off, and we were in a little cove. Well, when we came out of that cove, the people that were sitting on the dock or the pier that went out into the water, they sit there and told the Coast Guard and the game wardens and everything that, the driver never was watching the skier as well as me. Now, my back was sitting looking at the front of the boat because I was looking over the engine watching the skier. And the last thing I remember saying, doing or saying was, "Dina, he's up, slow down," because he had got up and started pointing down to, you know, to slow down some, and being the international sign to, from when I always skied, if you're going too fast, you point your thumb down to tell him to slow down. But the next thing I know was 10 days later, I'm waking up in the hospital. The people on the piers sit there and said that the driver, which was Dina, was looking over her shoulder as well at the skier, and we went under the pier that wasn't high enough to go under. And, of course, when the boat hit it, the front end of the boat shattered, and my head caught a 2x8 and threw me. And then my back ended up hitting the 2x8. Of the floor of the boat or the floor of the pier and slung me into the floor of the boat. And luckily the boat, instead of veering back out into the water, it veered onto the land. And one of the people on the shore had turned the engine off because it never died. And I was airlifted to the hospital here in, well, Richmond Memorial Hospital here in Columbia, with my neck and back broke, due to my head and back being introduced to a 2x6. I had 13 skull fractures from that accident with my neck. And of course, whenever I got out of the hospital, I think 21 days later, when my parents were getting me airlifted back to Texas, they'd sit there and told me, you know, go get used to a wheelchair that I'd never walk again. Come over and sit there and said, you know, Lillian thinks this is the best thing that ever happened to you. And I said, "Bobby, you tell her I will be back. Won't be seeing her, but I will be back."
So she said that was the best thing that ever happened to you, was to get your neck and back broken?
Yeah, that's what her words were. And it was the best thing that ever happened to me. I fought and battled for 2 years. And once again, you know, Joe Blanchard is the one that gave me my helping hand to get into wrestling, being training me and all. And I sat there and said I wanted to come back. And of course, he had talked to the neurosurgeons and everything, and that I had out in Corpus Christi. And they sat there and said, you know, it's best you don't. Kept bugging him and bugging him and bugging him. And I sat there and said, you know, David can too, but he was the referee. I said, if he thinks that I'm getting too crazy or things look too, you know, nutty, have him call the match. You know, I said, you know, he knows me from when I started. You know, he's been there right with me. And David and him discussed, and they were like, "All right, I can call it." And I said, "David, you can call it. If you think I'm that there's a chance I'm going to get hurt and you don't think I'll walk away, call the match." You know, but I said, "I'm going to be all right," you know, because I actually trained my niece. Before, you know, I had a ring set up in a building there in Alice, and she was always interested in it. You know, she was married and had a young boy at the time, but it gave us time to get together and everything. And then she was training really well, and then her son, you know, they'd say autistic to a way, but it comes out that he's not autistic. It was the doctors didn't realize that he couldn't hear. He was deaf. You know, he was born deaf. So he does have a speech impediment to this day, and now he's in his 30s and got grown kids and all. She chose, before they found all this out, that, you know, and I thought, well, if I can train somebody, it's harder to train somebody than it is to wrestle, truly wrestle, if you got somebody out there knowing what they're doing. And Joe and David actually had to agree, you know, because my comeback matches were against Evelyn Stevens, and, you know, and I guess she passed away about 7 or 8 years ago from cancer, for Evelyn Stevens. my niece, you know. Sit there, and it was one of those things, you know, she had the choice of, do I want to go on the road, or do I, and of course, the apple of her eye was her son, you know, so in trying to figure out what was wrong, because, you know, she knew that as long as he was looking at her, it was like he could figure out what she was saying. Well, then whenever it really come down to it, and them finding out that he was totally deaf, you know, it's like, you know, why didn't anybody realize this before he was 4 years old? Especially in the medical field, you would think that deafness would not be something that they were that unaware of. But I said, you know, she gave up wrestling to take care of her, you know, spend her time with her son to try to figure out what was going on. And I said, right. I guess it was... But that's what gave me the drive that if I could do that, then I could get back in the ring, you know, after my neck and back was broke.
Right. And then you had one other major mishap, and that was job related. Do you mind sharing that with us?
No. I was a zoning inspector, which that means I go out and tell people and contractors what they can and cannot do on the property that they own or that they bought to redevelop. And it changed my hours from 8:30 to 5 to 6:30 to 3, and or 6 to 3. And I sit there and department head sit there and said it was so I could catch people trying to put roofs on and without a permit. Well, it didn't cost you anything to get a roof permit. All it did was take the time to come down to City Hall and say you needed the permit to put the roof up so you could stick it out there on the front porch or in the middle of the yard to show that you had the permit saying the roof on. But I said, this happened in December. And nobody's going to be out in December to put a roof on a house here in Columbia, South Carolina, or out here on the East Coast to go with that.
I think you're right.
And I mean, I can understand if it was April, May, you know, anywhere from April on, they might, because the weather gets, you want to beat the heat. But they changed my hours the 1st of December, and I said December the 27th. I went in to work. I was getting there at about 5:47. Now, mind you, my hours start at 6, you know, my morning. And I pulled into the city parking lot because I told them I was going to park the city truck and where the city office was. I wasn't going to park it over at the parking garage because we had the homeless sleeping over there. And I didn't want to get over there and go to back up and run over somebody because they were up underneath the car or the truck sleeping. And city manager and everything agreed, and department head agreed that, you know, I could park there and, you know, just park truck where I was going to park my vehicle. Well, at the end of each day, well, as I got there to get in the car, the security lights, I drove a Saturn at the time, and the security lights did not come on to that my little Saturn. You know, you had to have a full-size vehicle for the security lights in the parking lot to come on. Well, I got out, and I was on... My car was right next to the dumpster, and the city vehicle was on the other side of the dumpster. You know, so I sat there and went to get in the car. Of course, the engineer's cars were parked just in front, but they were in a fenced-in area that had a razor wire on top of it because of all the equipment they carried in their vehicles, being in the engineers and all. And I sat there and said, tree that was over the park, hanging over this area where we parked in the parking lot, needed to have the tree trimmers come down and cut up and do the limbs because they were rotten and falling off, you know. Well, as I started to unlock the truck for me to get in, and because I had a Silver City Silverado truck, full-size truck, and I felt something hit me in my head, and I thought it was actually a tree limb in the beginning. Well, it hit me again. Well, when it hit me the second time, I went down to one knee, and when I looked down at the ground, I saw a foot. Well, all I could do was throw the keys, and I got him over the fence where the razor wire was, to where if he was trying to, because I, not only did I have the keys to the truck right there, now I had the keys to get into the city hall where everything was, all the other offices, not only for zoning, the water collections, and the engineering and bunch of offices, you know, the community development and everything. So I got them over the fence to where if they were trying to get in the office or you're trying to rob, you know, they were only going to get whatever I had. Well, I had stopped by the bank earlier that morning and pulled out some money that I was picking up some things. So whenever he's beating me up, they would never let me turn and face them. You know, the only
description they always kept you away from them, right?
Yeah, yeah. They stayed at my back, and you know, my immediate supervisor was upset because he threw me into the side of the city vehicle. I did over $3,000 worth of damage between my face and body. You know, and I've had broke nose, cracked ribs, concussion, teeth knocked loose. So, and I said, about the second time I sit there, I said, I also talk defensive. I could always sit there and remember telling them, you know, if you're outnumbered or you don't think you got a chance, I said, play dead, because you got a 50-50 chance anyway. You know, do you take more of a beating and get killed in the process, or do you play dead and possibly get away with a lesser beating, or still get shot and killed? I mean, you got the 50-50 chance of making it out, you know, if you just play dead. And
right.
So after he flung me across the parking lot and I had road rash going, I sat there and just laid there, you know, and they came and stood over me for a minute and then walked away. And then I heard him coming back, and I thought, oh, no, he saw me breathe. You know, now this is 5:50 in the morning, because I got there at like 5:47, because looking at the clock on my radio when I was getting out. Well, I got in the laying there. Well, he came back, and he grabbed my pocket, and I carried my ID in my back pocket. And he grabbed my ID, pants ripped when he did that, because he was just jerking me up, like, and then he took the ID and walked away again. Well, 3 weeks later, whenever the police are trying to do their investigation and everything, and I called the detective and sit there and said, you know, I had something come in the mail. Well, I took it down there, and my ID came back in the mail. Yeah, what, you know, and my description of the person was he had long dreadlocks, a shaggy beard, and street clothes where you could say it was layered, dirty looking clothes. But I said the only thing, they were wearing Polo cologne. Now, whether it was $3 Polo from a bathroom, who knows? But I said I knew that it was Polo cologne that he was wearing. You know, so he may have been dressed and looked shaggy wise like a street person, but he definitely did not smell like a street person. You know, because all the other mornings when I had to go over to the parking garage before I started getting those early morning hours, when you started going to the vehicle and you was passing the street people that were sleeping up there, you knew you had years around the street people because you kind of started looking for the roadkill. People wondering where it was laying at because you could smell them well before you got to them. Whenever they found out the wallet, they had it fingerprinted, but there were so many fingerprints on the wallet, my ID, that they couldn't say it was anybody's. And of course, they had the post office had started wearing gloves at this time because I think it's about the time the anthrax things happened. And so most of people were wearing gloves, so there was fingerprints. And I said, I don't remember the person having gloves on, but they wasn't able to find any thing where he touched, and but any other fingerprints than mine, and nothing left. And then whenever I broke ribs, ended up rupturing. They had pierced my colon and my intestines, and then whenever I went into the hospital, I fell at home and busted my head open. I had a friend come and pick me up to take me to the hospital because I couldn't keep the blood out of my eyes from where I hit my head and busted open my head. They got me there where the little intern was running tests, and it was showing my liver was working and my liver wasn't working. Well, they got another doctor come from another hospital, and he was going to do exploratory surgery, and this was like February the 7th of 2008. The attack took place December the 27th of 2007. And I, when Dr. Mira, the surgeon that was doing exploratory surgery because they couldn't figure out what was going on with my liver, the broke ribs where it pierced my colon and my intestines, whenever he cut me open, to see what was going on, my colon and my intestines both ruptured. And then it was like one of those, oh my God moments, you know, which one do I fix first? And then I don't remember anything until July the 7th when I was released in a wheelchair to go home. So from February the 7th to July the 7th of 2008, I spent in the hospital and went from 267 pounds down to 112.
My goodness.
Yeah. And they never caught the person. When my friend that worked in the office called the detective over to come look, because I said I thought I was set up. And whenever he came over and looked at the person, of course, I went through all the mug shots that they brought up to the hospital for me to look at, and all when I was come out of the coma, semi-coma. I said, you know, y'all are giving me pictures because I couldn't say if he was white, black, orange, yellow, red. You know, I mean, he would have been a dark-skinned construction worker. If it had been a white guy, it would have been a, as they call them out here, reds. If it had been a black guy, it could have been an Asian, Hispanic, Puerto Rican. You know, I had no one race or another that I could say he was, because they never spoke. So I had no distinct voice, but other than he was bigger than me, you know, and me being 6 foot, and at that time, 260 pounds. He was a big boy that grabbed me, you know, and for them to sling me around the way he did and be able to pick me up by the back of my pants, before they ripped one-handed, you know, I said, so, you know, he had to be somebody that knew something about lifting, because he darn sure wouldn't have been able to pull me up and got me up off the ground one-handed, unless he knew how to lift weights, because I wasn't no Barbie doll. But
right. Sounds like you had a heck of an experience, and you made it back to wrestling, didn't you?
Oh yeah, yeah. They said I'd never do it again because I was in a wheelchair, you know. And I thought might have been 3 years later, but I was back out of the wheelchair and back to calling promoters.
Well, that's great.
Surprisingly, when I see a lot of the guys, you know, that Ricky Morton, you know, from the Rock and Roll Express, you know, that some of my guys will say, you know, that I said, hey, and it's like, I heard she was killed. You know, I heard she was dead, you know, Robert Gibson, and it's like, even Ric Flair, you know, one of my boys would sit there and said that I trained him, and I said, well, I thought she'd died. He said, well, they gave up on us 3 times, but she kicked out. You know, she wasn't ready to go.
She kicked out. That's a great phrase, isn't it? Really is.
Yeah.
Well, look, thank you so much for being with us today and talking about some of the greats that you worked with and some of your more harrowing experiences. in the world of wrestling. I know it's been an exciting life, and we've got a lot more to go. So thank you so much.
Seven decades still kicking.
That's exactly right. Well, we'll have you back again. We'll talk about some more adventures in wrestling from the great, great Susan Green right here, sponsored by the Carolina Wrestling Hall of Fame. Susan, thanks, and we'll see you again soon, okay?
All right. You bet. Always a pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.